This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Once crypto king, once golden boy of crypto, once a modern day JP Morgan, that one time billionaire Tim and FTX co-founder Sam Bankman-Fried, as you know by now, sentenced to 25 years in prison for stealing billions of dollars from customers, marking the final chapter in a case that has both captivated and overshadowed the crypto industry.
With more on today's sentencing in the era of crypto and finance failure and fraud that the now 32-year-old SBF was behind, we welcome into the Bloomberg studio Bloomberg News legal analyst June Grasso. She's also host of Bloomberg Law, weeknights at 6 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio, along with Zeke Fox, Bloomberg News financial investigations reporter, also the author of Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. Zeke joining us on the phone from New York City because Zeke traveling after being in the courtroom this morning. Now, that's where we want to start, Zeke. What was it like in the courtroom earlier today when Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced and also ahead of that sentencing?
So it was packed as usual with reporters. And when Sam walked in, he was wearing his prison jumpsuit instead of a suit like during the trial, as is, you know, legal procedure. And he took the opportunity to address the judge like he did during his case. And I was watching to see if he would just apologize and take responsibility for what happened. For a minute, it sort of looked like he might, but then he fell back on his the story that he's been saying since FTX failed, which is that mistakes were made, the buck stops with me, but he's not admitting to stealing customer money.
All right, so I want to bring in June Grasso. June, so I am curious, that 25-year sentence, how much did the judge, potentially Judge Kaplan, use that, you know, that even in the 11th hour, Sam Bankman-Fried didn't come out and said, I committed a crime. How did that factor into the sentencing? Because it could have been much worse. It could have been a lot less, potentially. Yeah.
So even before the sentencing, Judge Kaplan had increased the guidelines range for Bankman-Fried after finding that he had perjured himself at his trial. And what he said at the sentencing was, when he wasn't outright lying, he was evasive, hair-splitting, dodging questions, and quote, I've never seen a performance quite like that. He took that into account, and I think that, you know, that weighed against Sam Bankman-Fried. He also took into account, you know, as Zeke said, he didn't think that he was sorry for what he had done. He said he expressed sympathy, expressed sorrow, but it wasn't real to him. And, you know, also, he had, before the sentencing, expanded the guidelines too, and he found that Sam Bankman-Fried had tampered with a witness. If you remember, before trial, Sam was out on bail, and the judge called him back to New York and abruptly threw him into prison despite the bail because he said he had been tampering with a witness. So, I mean, the judge had been through this whole trial watching Sam Bankman-Fried, and, you know, this is a very tough sentence. If you think about, though it is in line with some of the big kind of white-collar crime we've seen, for example, Jeff Skilling at Enron, I think he was sentenced to 24 years, and Bernie Ebers, 25 years. So it is in line with that, but you think about state crimes, if you commit a murder in state, basically, you know, you'll be out in 15 years or so. So they're making this white collar crime into what you
Bernie
consider
Madoff
more.
Bernie Madoff got 150 years.
Yeah. Bernie Madoff, that is held up as the most extreme example of how many years of defrauding people. So I think it was a tough, it is a tough sentence.
Hazy, come on back in here and give us an idea of what Sam Bankman-Fried was like when he found out that he got 25 years. If you saw any reaction from his parents who were in the courtroom, because his mom did write a lengthy letter to the judge in recent weeks about going being lenient in the sentencing.
Yeah, Sam was standing there, his hands folded. He was pretty impassive. It was hard to know what he was thinking. His parents also did not make a big dramatic reaction. I mean, his mom, yeah, she had written a pretty moving letter about what Sam was like as a child, how he was different from other kids, how he wasn't motivated by the same things as them, and how his commitment to making the world a better place was real. And the defense talked about that too, when his new lawyer gave a speech. But the defense said in kind of a good one-liner, he wasn't a monster, he was a math nerd. And, you know, if this was all the information you had, you know, it might be kind of convincing. But the problem was that this totally didn't address the fact that during the trial, his four best friends and top lieutenants at FTX in a row each took the stand and said, hey, no, we committed a giant fraud on purpose. We knew it was wrong. We did it anyway. Sam directed us to do it. And they presented a lot of evidence that showed that. So whether Sam was a nerd or whether he was actually greedy was kind of beside the point. It's like this fraud still occurred.
Hey, Zeke. Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, Zeke, I said, you bring up a really good point. We're talking about Caroline Ellison, Nishad Singh, and Gary Wong. Right now, they're awaiting their own fate after helping seal their former boss's conviction for pulling off a multi-billion-dollar fraud involving tens of thousands of customers. June, I have this question, and I don't know to what extent you can answer it because we're kind of playing, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda here.
Yeah.
But the three individuals I just mentioned, they all pleaded guilty and cooperated. What if Sam Bankman-Fried had pleaded guilty and cooperated with law enforcement?
So
what would he be facing right now?
As I understand, and Zeke may know better, as I understand, the prosecutors never offered him a deal. There weren't deal negotiations. So that's my understanding, that he wasn't offered a deal, that they got those three and the case against him then just built.
Zeke, was that the case?
That's true. And you have to imagine he would have gotten a lighter sentence if he just threw himself on the mercy of the court. But I have another interesting counterfactual. What if all of those people got together and decided, hey, let's stick to a different story. Let's say it was, you know, let's not admit to fraud. Let's all say we're not guilty. Could the government have enough evidence from documents and otherwise to convict them? I mean, they definitely had some evidence, but it would have been a lot harder. All of their text messages were set to auto-delete, so the government didn't have a lot of contemporary records of them, you know, agreeing to commit some of the key acts.
Someone always flips, though. Someone always flips, because you have three people, four people, and someone is going to feel nervous about it. And the prosecutors, you know, they ask them questions, they bring them in with their lawyers, and you know, it's very hard to imagine that all four of them would have kept to a story. So I think one of them would have flipped somewhere along the way.
Zeke, let me ask you. I mean, the lawyers, you know, said that they expect to recover more money, or enough money, excuse me, to pay back everyone in full in terms of FTX investors. So having said that, I don't know, does it speak to that, you know, they actually kind of figured out some things and did it well in the crypto space? Like, how do you read that, interpret that?
Yeah. So it is pretty wild that when FTX failed, there was $8 billion missing. And now the lawyers running the bankrupt company are like, we've recovered enough money that we think we'll be able to pay all of that back to the customers. And the reason, though, is not that the money was never stolen. It's that a lot of it comes from this huge run-up in crypto prices. Basically, when FTX failed in Alameda, they still had some crypto. And it wasn't stuff they thought they could sell quickly enough to satisfy all the customer demand, hence the bankruptcy. But now they've had more time, and the price of one of these tokens in particular, Solana, is up like tenfold. And if the bankruptcy estate is able to sell it all while the market is hot, they'll make like $10 billion. It's crazy. So that's essentially, it's not that the customer money wasn't misappropriated. Mm-hmm. It's that he did make some good gambles with it, it looks like, or with the help of these bankruptcy lawyers.
I mean, Zeke, you literally...
The judge didn't believe that, by the way.
Go
the
ahead. Judge yeah, said talk about that, the defense, because that was an interesting moment today.
Because that was also what was in the defense papers. Hey, there's not really a loss here. They're going to be paid back. And the judge said, the defendant's assurance that they'll be paid in full is misleading. It is logically flawed. It is speculative. The judge, basically, everything that they threw at him, the defense, including that Sam Bankman-Fried is autistic, he twisted it around and used it against Sam Bankman-Fried. So they said he's autistic. And he said, well, he is autistic, but that gives him a great capacity to do things.
I mean, worried just, the Judge Kaplan worried about what he might do next.
Yeah, that was that's chilling to me, and yeah. I just was reading it. He said, because the defense was arguing he's young, he has an opportunity to do so many things. They tried to compare him to Michael Milken and what could happen if he comes out, charitable work, and the judge said no, he just wanted power. He was power hungry, and he said there's a risk that this man will be in a position to do something very bad in the future. It's not a trivial risk. And I was shocked by that.
It's interesting, right?
Well, I want to talk to Zeke about that, because Zeke, before the downfall of Sam Bankman-Fried, before the fall of FTX, you spent some time one-on-one with SBF. You got to know him a little bit for a pretty big story in Business Week that you recently recounted in the Big Take podcast. Talk a little bit about what he's... Maybe it was the Spellcaster podcast. Excuse me. It was in one of the great podcasts that our team has done.
Tim listens to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts. That's the message.
A lot of podcasts with Zeke. Talk a little bit about what his personality was like and what really shocked you about this guy.
So some people after FTX failed have taken this to mean that, you know, everything about Sam was a lie. And I actually don't think that that's true. When I met him, what really made him seem different and interesting was that this was a guy who, he told me this story about how when he was a teenager, he met a philosopher who convinced him that the best way to help the world would be to get really rich and give all the money away. I'm meeting him, it's like 9 years later, and he's worth $20 billion. And I actually think from like all my time getting to know him and talking to people in his circles, this part of the story is really true. And that actually is what it made him dangerous, because when he was presented with the chance to either, he could justify anything that he wanted to do by saying, hey, there's like a real chance that if we're successful, we might do something that could change world history. So what's a little fraud here and there? Like, we might literally save millions of lives if we get rich enough and make trillions of dollars. And he was a guy who thought about the odds all the time. He was somebody who weighed the odds. Like, what are the odds I'm going to get caught? What are the odds if I'm successful? I mean, to be fair, this is my take. Now, he did not admit to this and say sorry today. But I think that's why they're saying he's dangerous, because if he has another chance to, his philosophy, in my opinion, would justify trying again.
The means justify... The end is basically what it is. Hey, June, I want to ask you, this was a punitive sentencing. This was about sending a message. Is it clear that Judge Kaplan did just that when it comes to, I don't know, not just crypto, but finance fraud?
I think that that was part of what this was all about. And he said that this is about, you know, stopping people from doing this in the future. And afterwards, the Manhattan U.S. attorney, Damian Williams, put out a statement. And he also said that this is a way of warning people about this. So that's part of the sentence, because this is such a high-profile case. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, for example, Mark Mukasey got... Trevor Milton 4 years instead of 11. That case was high profile, but not like this. This was crazy. So I think that the judge felt that he had to send a message.
Is there appeal? Can this be reduced real quickly?
Well, there is going to be an appeal. He says they're going to appeal the conviction and the sentence. Mm-hmm. But you know, appeals are very difficult in cases like this. And he has a new team. He has a great team. But so we'll see what happens with that. And the judge also asked that he be put in a low security prison because of his autism, and that it might be difficult for him in a regular prison. Although he seems to be getting along okay at Brooklyn Correction.
Well, a fascinating, I guess, final chapter, perhaps?
No appeal yet.
Well, that's right. Okay, so not quite a final chapter. To both of you, thank you so much. Really bringing a lot of clarity and analysis to this story. Bloomberg News legal analyst June Grosso, host of Bloomberg Law, weeknights at 6 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio, so catch that. And Zeke Fox, immeasurable in terms of his insight, too, on the world of crypto. Bloomberg News financial investigations reporter. Check out his book, Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We just talked with Bloomberg's Matt Day about Amazon's plan to spend almost $150 billion over, I think, 15 years on data centers needed for the AI boom. Data centers, Tim, we know one of the real estate investment plays we've heard a lot about for years. More recently, the focus and concern when it comes to commercial real estate has been on offices, as working from home, as we know, still sticks for many post-pandemic, Tim.
Yeah, the Bloomberg REIT Office Property Index down about 2% so far this year. It lost 3% in 2023. But Carol dropped close to 40% back in 2022.
All right, with a look at the commercial real estate space, we welcome Lauren Huckfelder. She's co-CEO of real estate investing over at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. She joins us right here in New York City. Lauren, welcome to Bloomberg. Hey, commercial real estate, we know location, 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 but it also can be divided into a lot of different buckets. You've got office, retail, you've got data centers, you've got industrial. Walk us through the different sectors. Where are you seeing strength and where's the continued weakness, like perhaps office?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. And I would say it's funny you use the old expression, location, location, location. That is absolutely paramount in real estate. But, you know, today we talk about dislocation, dislocation, dislocation. We have to look at what's changing, what's being disrupted, and invest accordingly. So yes, take office, take U.S. commodity office in particular, and it is absolutely being disrupted. You have a dramatic demand destruction. We all know that people tried out working from home in the pandemic and decided it wasn't so bad, so we're seeing a dramatic demand destruction. But frankly, also, those assets just don't meet modern tenant demands. They don't meet them from a standpoint of quality or amenitization. Frankly, they don't meet their carbon reduction goals. So these are assets that many of which will be stranded because they simply don't have long-term cash flow growth potential. But go to the opposite.
Can I jump in there, though? So U.S. commodity office, you're saying it's going to be stranded. So what happens and what are the financial implications, whether it's to the owners of those properties, to the banks who hold the loans on those properties? How does that play out? And then how does that maybe make more valuable some of the higher tier office property?
That's a fantastic question. Well, I'll start with the end. So you're seeing a massive consolidation of demand into the best of the best assets. So perhaps counterintuitively, the destruction of demand for more commodity space is actually driving increased demand for the best of the best. I'll give you an example. Take San Francisco. San Francisco office is one of the worst markets globally. And I can tell you, even in San Francisco, we own some of the best office assets in that market. even today, we're signing leases at rents above pre-COVID levels. Hmm. So to your point, it speaks to the benefits to the best.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those benefits or what that offers potential tenants. I mean, what exactly in 2024, in this world of hybrid work that we live in, a world where AI companies are just flourishing in the Bay Area and bringing people back to the city, what does an office building need to provide to attract and retain tenants right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's amenities. It's a focus on wellness. It is all of the bones, if you will. So big open ceiling heights, big open windows. But ultimately, it comes down to, I think, amenitization, wellness, and of course, location.
So can buildings that don't offer those things right now, can they be converted at a reasonable cost to buildings that will soon become attractive?
There's a lot of talk about converting old office buildings into other uses, converting it into residential, converting it into life science or lab space. And the reality is some assets will be converted. We've seen success stories, for example, here in New York after September 11th, a lot of office buildings in Lower Manhattan were converted to residential buildings, but two things were different. One, many of those office buildings had smaller floor plates, so physical structures that were more conducive to conversion. And two, frankly, there was government subsidy for that. And I think that the math is simply, even for those assets that have the right physical footprint, the math is very challenging when you get to overhauling the mechanical systems, everything going up and down the building.
Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you, obviously front and center here, coming off the unfortunate bridge collapse in Baltimore, and we are once again talking about supply chains, and that is certainly an investment trend that you guys are seeing. You call it a second mega trend tailwind driving demand in the industrial real estate space, and it has to do with the global supply chain. Talk to us about that, and you guys are investing this way?
Absolutely. So I would say in contrast to office, we love industrial real estate. We love it on a global basis, and it's really for two reasons. The first is e-commerce. So that's very much been the story of the last decade. So we, as all of us started buying an increasing share of our goods online versus in-store and frankly demanding it get to us faster and faster, we started buying and building those warehouses that get goods to our front doors every day. And as e-commerce penetration went, grew by 2.5x, so too did rents. So that's been a great tailwind for U.S. industrial real estate, for global industrial real estate. And I think that will continue, albeit decelerate. The second mega trend, and it's really at the earlier innings, so even more exciting, is the overhaul in the global supply chain. Look, we're coming off decades of a super smooth, super efficient global supply chain. We've all enjoyed the disinflationary benefits of that supply chain, but now things are changing. You look at what happened tragically in Baltimore this week, but I think it's really, it goes well beyond that. Among the many things that COVID laid bare was the fragility of the global supply chain, and we live it daily now. It is event-driven supply shocks, so COVID certainly being an enormous one, but you also have what's going on in the Panama Canal or labor disputes at the port, so event-driven supply shocks. And frankly, you have the overlay of geopolitics or global.
Hey, Lauren, we only have 30 seconds left, but I do want to talk politics, not geopolitics. How do investors in this space need to follow the presidential election? Do things change for you if Biden loses and Trump wins?
Just got about 20 seconds.
Look, politics affects everything, but ultimately we are focused around big mega trends that are durable demand drivers, regardless of who's in office.
All right, interesting stuff. And certainly it feels like this is going to be continuing a chapter in the real estate space. And in general, kind of we talk about in terms of how office plays its way out and then just kind of where investors are going. Hey, Lauren, thank you so much. Lauren Hochfelder, co-CEO, Real Estate Investing at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, joining us in New York City.
You're
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, a salvage firm that helped contain the Deepwater Horizon oil spill and safely blow up part of New York's Tappan Zee Bridge is heading to Baltimore as a first step to what will likely become a more than $2 billion rebuilding project.
Yeah, and Tim, someone who knows the Baltimore area very well, having been born there, is well known to our Bloomberg audience, as he is the host of Peer to Peer Conversations on Bloomberg, is Carlyle co-founder and co-chairman David Rubenstein, who I caught up with last night to talk about the bridge as well as some news earlier in the day. We started, though, on the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
I want to start with something that we have certainly been focusing on the last 24 hours or so, and that is what's going on in Baltimore. You were raised there, born there, the collapse, obviously, of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. How important is this bridge to the area? What does it mean to the people who live in and around that area?
It's an important bridge to people in this area. It's an important bridge for the country in many ways because many important ships go through that channel there. But the bridge itself is iconic, well-known, named after a very famous person, of course, Francis Scott Key. But it is a sad situation that it couldn't have been prevented. Apparently, the ship lost control or lost its power and therefore couldn't control where it went from based on what I read. And I think that at this point, there's been a loss of life. It's tragic. The governor is on top of it. He's an incredibly impressive person. And he and the Secretary of Transportation are on top of what needs to be done. And President Biden has said that the federal government will put up the money to fix the bridge, but it's going to take time. So there'll have to be a way to figure out how to get people across that area, which is otherwise, reached by the bridge. But, sad situation for the city, for sure.
But I just want to ask you, as someone who's lived in the area, right, I think, you know, when we live across the country or we're not from that area, we think, okay, it's another bridge. And obviously, loss of life, first and foremost, we feel bad for that. But I'm just, in terms of the area and you growing up in that area, like how you think about that bridge?
Well, the bridge is one that is an important part of the commerce of this area. Important for people that live in the area. It wasn't actually built when I was growing up in Baltimore. It was built afterwards, but it's an important bridge and serves a great purpose. It's just so tragic that the ship lost power and it was in the middle of the night. And you couldn't really help easily rescue people. But Baltimore has had many challenges in recent years. This is a challenge, but this is a challenge that, you know, we can recover. You can't recover the lives of people who are gone. But I think the bridge can be rebuilt. It just takes time to build bridges, and therefore there'll have to be some temporary measures to get people across that area.
We certainly have heard from various government officials about that specifically, about the time that's going to be needed to get certainly the port up and running, but even more importantly, the longer-term time that it will take in terms of getting that bridge rebuilt. Are you confident that the government will do what it needs to get that bridge rebuilt in a timely manner?
I'm confident that the government has the intent to get it done as quickly as possible. And the President of the United States, the governor of Maryland, the mayor of Baltimore, all unified. It's not a political issue. Just a question of, you know, it's something that it takes time to build, and you got to redesign a bridge, and you got to get structural engineers, and you got to get construction people. So it's a multi-year effort to get that rebuilt. There's no doubt.
And as I said, we've heard from the government. Is there something that the private sector can do? Is there a public, you know, private partnership that needs to be thought about in terms of getting this bridge up and running and rebuilt?
Well, typically you have public-private partnerships when there's a need to involve the private sector in some way, and the government can help with financial support. Here, the government is putting up all the money necessary for the rebuild. So the private sector, I think, can probably help the most by raising funds for the families who lost their loved ones in this tragic accident. And I think that's something the federal government doesn't typically provide support for. And so I think you'll see private sector money focused on that for the immediate future.
All right. And David, we definitely obviously appreciate you weighing in on the collapse.
Sure.
I think we would be remiss not to ask about some big news for you personally today, and that is about the Baltimore Orioles. You tweeted it out about ownership, Major League Baseball's owners today unanimously approving you as the new controlling owner of the Baltimore Orioles just before opening season begins, or the season begins. Congratulations. You've wanted this team for years. What's gone through your mind now that you've got it?
Well, whenever you achieve something you want, you always have to wonder what bad things can happen, because you know, life can't always be perfect. So I'm very pleased. We have a great team, a great investment group that I've assembled. But, you know, it's 162 games, and it's, you know, you're considered successful if you win, you know, 100 or so of them. So you're going to lose a fair number of games. So we have an opening day tomorrow. Hopefully the weather will cooperate, and we'll do well in opening day. But it's a long season. Just pleased that I was able to do this. I came from very modest circumstances in Baltimore. Never dreamed that I would be able to buy the Orioles when I was growing up. But, you know, life moves forward in strange ways, and things worked out. And I'm happy to view this as a way to help give back to Baltimore for having helped me get a very good education here.
I feel like it's an obvious question. I'm assuming you will be sitting in the owner's box tomorrow at Camden Yards.
It's an obvious question, but the answer is not obvious.
Ah.
I will be. I have some friends, relatives, and others coming, but I don't want to be there that long because I want to move around the stadium and see what the fans think. And I'll be sitting in various parts of the stadium and sitting next to the average fans. That's what I hope to do in that game and other games.
That's really lovely to hear. And the other thing I want to ask you is, it's a team obviously you've thought about for a long time, as you said. You feel, I can hear it in your voice, that, you know, lucky to have it as your team and be part of the ownership there. It is a young team, made the playoffs last year. What are your plans? How are you thinking about that?
We have the best manager in the American League, as voted by the league last year, and the best general manager. Nobody has ever thought that my baseball expertise was quite at the level of those two individuals. So I'm going to rely on them on what to do. And I'll try to be as supportive as possible from the business side. But clearly on the player side, you know, I mean, we have it in the hands of people that are really experts. And my job is to kind of help them do what they need to do.
So if they say we need to spend more on the team payroll, would you be up for that?
I'm going to follow the advice of the people that know what they're doing in baseball. So I'll look at what they recommend. So I just don't want to be committing to any one thing or getting people's hopes up beyond what I can realistically do. So I think I want to rely on Mike Elias, who's the incredible general manager we have, and Brandon Hyde, the great manager we have. And beyond that, I don't think I can say more.
Hey, listen, and I don't know what you can say about the dispute that's been going on for a long time with Masson. Is there anything in terms of moving that forward and getting some kind of resolution?
I do think that it would be helpful to baseball generally and helpful to the Nationals and the Orioles to have some type of resolution. But obviously, when you have something that's going on for 10 years of dispute, no one can come in overnight and say, I've got a solution that none of you thought of. So it's something that we want to resolve. I think the commissioner of baseball would like to see it resolved, but it's going to take some time to dig into it. And obviously, lawyers have benefited from this over the years, but hopefully we can get it resolved without the lawyers being too deeply involved, and we can get it resolved before too long. But it's beyond that, I can't really say.
Hey, David, one more thing. You know, you talk about tomorrow, you know, being among the fans and walking around the stadium. And I do wonder how you think about it. I know it's something we talk about in New York a lot, about the expensive cost of taking a family of four to go see a team. And how do you think about, you know, making this, you know, wonderful sport and this team, you know, accessible to everyone?
Well, people in New York who want to go to a baseball game might find it cheaper to come to the Orioles game than to go to the Mets or the Yankees game. So we welcome everybody in New York to come to Baltimore, which is less expensive and a beautiful city, Charm City as it's known. So I think the prices here are more affordable, even with the transportation. So I hope people from New York who might be listening will say, let's go to Baltimore.
All right, I'm going to let all the New York fans. Hey, I lied. One more question. You've been the chairman of the Kennedy Center Honors for 14 years. You've got one more year. You step down tomorrow. I know it sounds like taking something off your plate, you've got a lot going on, is understandable. But any thoughts about that? It's something that I've enjoyed watching with my family. And I'm just curious, as you wrap that up and move on to other things, how you're thinking about that.
Well, the Kennedy Center has been something I've chaired for 14 years. I'll finish at the end of December, but then I'll become the chairman of the Kennedy Center Foundation, which is designed to help raise money for the endowment of the Kennedy Center. So I'll still be involved there a bit, but I think it's a good time to get somebody who's younger and fresher than me. And I have one more honors to do, and we're going to pick the honorees in the near future. And hopefully everybody will think it's a great selection.
All right, David, thank you so much. Any celebrating tonight?
We have the investors and many of the key people in the Orioles organization having a dinner tonight, and I will host that dinner with some of my partners, yes.
All right, that, of course, is Carlisle co-founder and co-chairman David Rubenstein. Conversation I had with him last evening, obviously talking about the bridge, but also the news yesterday that he is now the owner of the Baltimore Orioles. That's a big deal, John Tucker.
Does that mean we get tickets?
Well, what? We should point
out. How does this benefit me, John Tucker?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm kidding.
We should point out, though, Michael R. Bloomberg, of course, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, is also part of that investor group.
Just like when the Yankees here in New York go play Baltimore, Camden Yards is a fantastic stadium.
You love that stadium.
Yeah, it's a great trip, by the way. Sometimes you get more Yankee fans in Baltimore than
because it's a good deal because it's cheaper. Or what?
No, it's a great trip.
Yeah, it's a great trip. All right, folks. Carol Messer, Tim Stenovic. More to come. We're going to talk about the markets right here on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app, or watch us live on YouTube.
So we want to go further with Apple, a company in the crosshairs of, it seems, regulators around the globe. Here in the U.S., as you know, 1 week ago, the U.S. Justice Department and 16 attorneys general sued Apple, accusing the iPhone maker of violating antitrust laws by blocking rivals from accessing hardware and software features on its popular devices.
Indeed. Well, our next guest believes misguided antitrust actions could harm consumers and small businesses and only lead to increased government intervention. So here to explain her view is Jennifer Huddleston. She's Technology Policy Research Fellow at the Cato Institute, adjunct professor at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Jennifer, good to have you here on Bloomberg. So let's get to it. It sounds like you don't agree with this action by the U.S. Justice Department. Lay it out for us.
What we have is the U.S. Justice Department trying to very narrowly define a market in order to show a market dominance that doesn't actually reflect the reality that most consumers have or why Apple is a large, successful company. Instead, what we have is a bit of a return of a big is bad mentality, the idea that certain companies, because of their size, should be immediately subject to greater regulatory scrutiny. But if we think about some of the issues brought up in the complaint, things like the idea that you get a green bubble in messaging if you have an Android device, the reality is that many consumers are choosing from a lot of different messaging options, not just text message and iMessage, but any array of apps that are out there like WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, and so on. This also makes a lot of presumptions about what the smartphone market is. The average consumer, when they're choosing a smartphone, is going to consider many, many different features beyond just the operating system. They may be thinking about things like the camera or the availability of certain apps, or the privacy and security features of a phone.
Hey, one thing I do want to just, for transparency, make clear to our audience is understand the funding of the Cato Institute. We do this with our think tank guests. So give us an idea of where the funding comes from for the Cato Institute and if Apple is one of the companies that does support the Cato Institute.
I'm here to talk about my research. I don't work on our development team. The Cato Institute is funded by a wide range of individuals, and I can direct any questions you might have on that to the appropriate sources.
All right. And companies, though, to be fair. So we just want to make sure the transparency is out there. What is it about your research says that, you know, consumers would be hurt and small businesses would be hurt by this decision?
Well, when we look at what's gone on in the past, when we have seen something that was not the consumer welfare standard applied in antitrust, whether it was in the U.S. in a prior antitrust era, or if it was looking to Europe, what we have traditionally seen is that that focuses more on subjective means of measuring what is good and bad for competition. And it really sets up for a potential government intervention against politically disfavored companies. And it can actually take away some of those very features that consumers enjoy, whether it's the ability to know that an ecosystem is closed and therefore they feel that it's more secure because they know that that's the way that the product was designed, or whether it is to, you know, look at other aspects of the smartphone market, particularly for small developer for app store developers. This could change the way that the app store works as well, and the way that different elements that are currently available are, such that it makes it much more complicated and in some ways could make every phone the same rather than really allowing a wider range of options for consumers.
Jennifer, what about the take rate for Apple, that 30% fee that it takes from stuff that's purchased through apps that are downloaded from the Apple App Store? I'm wondering your thoughts on that and if there are any antitrust concerns about that. Just to remind our viewers and listeners, it's the idea that when you buy something through an app that you downloaded through Apple's App Store, whether or not that app comes from Apple or not, Apple does get, and these are digital goods we're talking about, Apple does get a portion of that. And that's what really set things off with regulators, and that's where Epic Games was coming from.
And we've actually already seen that issue largely litigated in the Epic Games case, in which the court found mostly in favor of Apple's process. I think the question there is also, is that actually an antitrust concern? Is that actually an anti-competitive behavior? Or is that a matter of contract law? Is this a case of companies that can negotiate with each other over a fee the way that we would see in an offline world? If this was a shopping mall, for example, or Walmart or a department store like Nordstrom, and they were having a negotiation with someone who wanted to sell something in their space, we would say that's a contract negotiation. And different companies may or may not like the terms of those contracts, but we would say that's a contract dispute and not necessarily an antitrust issue.
Jennifer, what would rise to the an antitrust issue, in your opinion, when it comes to Apple? What would you have to see from the company to say, okay, this is an instance where we need to see regulators get involved?
We would want to see something that indicated that it was anti-competitive behavior and not just the case of having a product that responds to what consumers want and having a product that has been very popular with consumers. So we would be looking for things that were actually somehow distorting the market, as opposed to something that's just a result of a company's success. We want companies to be responding to what their consumers want and creating products that meet those demands. And that may mean that they're successful and that they drive innovation as a result, that other companies have to really rise to that challenge.
Well, to be fair, I mean, we talk about it a lot, right, Tim? We've talked about, I mean, I'm an Apple family and we've made a choice. And so everything we do is within the Apple universe. And having said that, we don't necessarily as consumers know that if Apple was more open with its platform, whether or not we might benefit from that as consumers. So it's hard to kind of make that case, right, without knowing whether or not by opening it up and not being so closed in terms of the Apple system, whether or not we actually might benefit.
There is an alternative system out there in that the Android system provides a different option. And so for people that are looking at wanting to have that more sideloading experience, there are options out there where there's a wider range of operating systems. Apple has really tried to distinguish itself in the market through kind of having this closed ecosystem that they market as better for privacy and security. And that's part of their marketing strategy and what they feel is their role and their competitive advantage in the market. Intervening in that would take away a company's option of really portraying themselves as that privacy-centric option.
I'm wondering what you think of the idea of an environment being created where startups can flourish. And I think that a lot of people would point to the antitrust action taken against Microsoft in the 90s that essentially hobbled Microsoft for so many years, created this foundation in Silicon Valley where a lot of startups that are now the biggest companies in the world were actually able to succeed and flourish. Do you think Apple and other big companies are preventing startups from succeeding in this day and age because of their size?
we continue to have a really flourishing ecosystem of startups in the US. And we're very lucky that there are very low barriers to entry to start a company because of how we've had a light touch regulatory approach to regulation. I get concerned with some of the calls to change antitrust law around mergers and acquisitions, not only for the impact that could have on large companies, but for the impact that could have on some of those small companies. Some companies want to be the next Apple, the next Google, the next Microsoft, and IPO and get really big. Others are looking at other exit strategies where they want to make an existing product better, or perhaps, you know, there's someone who the better option is to get acquired by a large company and continue to be a serial entrepreneur. So what we ideally want is something that has a wide range of exit strategies for companies of all sizes so that they're really focused on benefiting consumers and on trying and failing in the marketplace.
Jennifer, we only have 15 seconds left, but how do you think this plays out in court over the next few years?
I think the next few years is key there. This is going to be a long case. We're going to see a lot of conversations and a lot of further discussion on this issue.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, listen, thank you so much. Jennifer Huddleston, Technology Policy Research Fellow at the Cato Institute, joining us from Washington, D.C. And I will say, Tim, our own legal analysis, Jen Ree here at our Bloomberg Intelligence team on this case, saying that, you know, it's probably going to be 3 years in the making, and says that there is a lot that can happen in the technology world that might make it a very different case in that time frame.
Once again, a good thing for lawyers.
They always seem to win.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, TikTok, just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic getting ready to wrap up the holiday shortened trading week and wrap up, Tim, the first quarter that was quite a stellar quarter if you were a bull in the equity markets here in the U.S.
Yeah, really curious what Alan Zafran has to say about that. He's founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital. He joins us once again from Foster City, California. Alan, how are you?
I'm great, Tim and Carol. How are you doing?
We're doing pretty well. Hard to believe.
We just opened up our 401ks and we're like,
No, the trick, Carol, is never look. That's the trick.
Don't you look periodically?
Yes.
Of course you do.
Yeah, way too much.
All right.
What do you think of what happened this quarter? I mean, how does it mesh with what you thought would happen in the first quarter of the year? And where do you think we're going in the remaining 75% of the year?
Well, first of all, the equity rally surprised me probably as much as many investment professionals. So now we're calling it a 501k or 601k, Carol, not a 401k.
Right.
I like that.
But, you know, here's what happened. In retrospect, it's easy to see it in retrospect. The market investors basically determined the Fed pivoted its policy in mid-October. And the easiest way to consider that is you look at the yield on the two-year treasury. It peaked in mid-October around 5.25%. It's right now at about 4.62%. Once the market concluded the Fed had pivoted, everyone concluded it was time to be bullish again and put money back into the markets. And if you look at history, markets always rally, even if economic activity is weakening post the Fed pivot. So that's what we think is happening. You have a liquidity-washed market, and it goes to the old adage, time in the market is better than timing the market. So despite my skepticism with a looming recession, sitting on our hands and not taking steps to make any changes ended up being the right decision.
Having said that, okay, so we're getting ready for the Powell pivot, or Powell and Company pivoted. But yesterday, as we've been talking about, Alan, Fed Governor Chris Waller saying that recent inflation data make him hesitant to cut rates as soon as he did a couple of months ago. And it's kind of interesting. So, you know, you do wonder, and I'm curious about what Jay Powell will say ultimately tomorrow, whether or not we're starting to get a little bit more managed about, yeah, maybe it's 3, maybe it's 2, maybe it's 1, maybe it's none. Like, I don't know. I guess we need to see and read the tea leaves here.
You're actually highlighting what we think is a greater risk to the market. Here's the irony. We would tell you greater economic strength with more inflation and a higher rate environment is actually more problematic and scary in the short run for markets than a slowdown economically, even into a recession. In other words, we're at a near all-time high of correlation with where yields are and what's happening with stock prices. And so our view is the biggest near-term risk to the market is not a slowdown economically. It's a pickup in inflation, a Fed that doesn't lower the Fed funds rate, and people have to unwind all their expectations about the rate cuts, and we change the valuations we're paying for these stocks. So that is, in fact, the risk.
What's the balance of someone like you who watches the markets has to come out with advice and say the balance between, okay, growth, good, a little bit of inflation, good, maybe, versus a recession or deep recession and fallout?
Well, stocks historically are actually an inflation hedge. It's only in times of extreme inflation where stock markets tend to fall, or disinflation with a recession. So we would argue, you know, it's semantics, but whether it's 1.5 to 3.5% inflation is completely tolerable. What you're really looking for in the long run is, if you think about it mathematically, stocks are giving you real GDP growth of around 4%, inflation of another 3%. You get your 2% dividend yield. And on average, stock share counts drop by about 1% a year. More shares are repurchased or redeemed than issued. Mm-hmm. So 4, 3, 2, 1, that's a 10% rate of return. That's the historical rate of return in the market. So inflation doesn't prevent the 4% economic growth as long as it's kind of in that 1.5 to 4% range. The problem is when it gets too low, it's telling you there's no growth in the economy, or when it's way too high, consumers can't afford to pay prices anymore. Companies have to raise prices to the point they crowd out consumption, and it leads to recession. So inflation is okay to a point, and in this environment we're in, it's plenty fine as long as the pressure isn't great enough to cause rates to go a lot higher.
Hey, Alan, I've been asking all our guests about asset allocation lately, given that we are seeing really highs in a lot of different asset classes right now. Someone comes to you with new money. How do you deploy it?
Obviously, let's go back to risk tolerance, investment timeline, age, goals, objectives, income needs, tax rate. But as a generalization, we would argue it's no different than any other time, but we would always argue whatever you're going into, dollar cost average. So if I was going to tell you you are 40 years old, you might be 60% stocks and 40% bonds, but that 60% in stocks, I'm going to take 10 to 12 months to dollar cost average you in. So you're buying 10% of the stocks every month for 10 months, and you get an average cost. You don't put all the money in on day one, because it's very hard emotionally to put all your money in the stock market, and 3 weeks later, if the market's down, you'll panic. So we would tell you it's status quo. It's no different than a normal time right now, but normal time means you tiptoe into markets. You don't put all your eggs into the basket on the very first day.
All right. So you shared with our producer, Paul Brennan, 10 market themes for 2024. You believe a new bull market is underway, Alan. Lower interest rates finally bring economic reacceleration in sight. Markets are volatile, but we think they resolve higher. And you say this bull market, this new bull market, requires a different playbook, and that you believe interest rates and inflation will ultimately set her at a higher baseline level compared to the last 15 years. So this is a rethink. Do we get the Fed to buy in on that rethink, you think, anytime soon, and kind of admit that?
Yeah, I do. I actually think the Fed has already admitted it, but they don't want to be a Fed like Arthur Burns in the 1970s that let inflation creep back in and created a massive recession. So what they're going to do is they're purposely going slowly. They'd rather keep rates a little bit too high, a little too long to guide us into this new economic environment than lower rates too quickly, reinstigate inflation and cause a greater havoc. So I do think that's the playbook. But I think they are, in fact, going to be methodical working us back down in the way they tiptoe us back down on the yield curve.
Favorite investment idea, somewhere where you would commit money right now and be as specific as you can?
Private credit. So you can buy both in public markets, there are vehicles, as well as in the private markets. Private credit is basically a set of loans, senior and floating rate, issued to, but largely to private companies. And because they're tied to the effectively the Fed funds rate, it's called SOFR. It's like what LIBOR was. Mm-hmm. Companies are, they, you as the investor are lending money to a basket of businesses that are giving you anywhere from 5.5% to 7.5% above the 5.5% Fed funds rate. So you're making
no worry though. There's a lot of transparency concerns about that. Alan, just got about 20 seconds.
But if you're the senior floating rate lender on loans that are 3 or 4, and if you go into a pool of thousands of loans, the propensity to lose money in that is exceptionally small. So an experienced manager with a well-diversified portfolio can make a very good private credit issuance. Mm. Note, it's ordinary income. So that's the challenge.
It's an argument in favor we've heard a lot about, but interesting. And there's also, though, some nervousness about the sector. Alan, thank you so much. Have a good holiday weekend. Alan Zafran, founding partner, co-CEO at IEQ Capital, joining us there from California. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.